Don't ever forget it. But really, without you new people, this thing would probably end up with all us old-timers sitting around here telling these same old stories. We probably all get drunk, you know? I'm what this book says is a real alcoholic. In fact, I'm one of them bar-drinking drunks. Are there any bar-drinkers here tonight? Thank God. I mean, I don't know where the rest of you did your thing, but I'll tell you this. If you didn't get some bar time in, you missed a lot of fun. I liked everything about those joints, you know? I like everything that goes on in there. I like the smell in there. I like them stools you can spin around on. I like the mirrors that they have in them joints, you know? Fact of life, you know? Ted and I could go out here on the main drag at Maple View. Open up a joint tomorrow without a mirror. Fact of life, we'd go broke in 1 week. Yeah. Three things you have to have in this country in order to operate a bar. You know that? One, you got to have the booze. Second, you got to have a license to sell it. And third, you got to have a mirror. Or you will not make it in a bar business. That mirror, incidentally, is not there for social drinkers. Bars cannot survive on social drinkers. They depend on people who drink in volume. And you and I are the volume drinkers of this world. Social drinkers do weird stuff in bars. You bar drinkers know what I'm talking about. You know, they come in there, they have a couple drinky poos, and then they start saying weird off the wall kind of stuff like, "Ooh, I'm getting dizzy. I'm going home." Going home? People like you and I, we sit there all day. And we have to have something to entertain ourselves, and it's usually our own image, left the mirror. You know, we sit there all day staring in a mirror, you know, figuring things out. I like them jukeboxes they have in them joints. You know, the ones that play Born to Lose every day. I even got to like the men's John in those joints. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, we used to have a guy around AA by the name of Norm Alpe, who, in my opinion, is the greatest speaker Alcoholics Anonymous ever had, ever will have. And he was a bar drinking drunk, and the first time I heard him, he was up at one of these podiums, and he talked fast. I think he's the only man up till tonight that can give a one-hour talk in 32 minutes, you know. He'd shoot it out really fast, and you had to listen close to catch it. And he's up there this night, and he's ranting and raving and going on and on about all kinds of stuff. And finally, he said he got to be a bathroom slider in the men's john. And right away, one of the bananas fell out of my ears, and I thought, what's that clown talking about? Because I thought I'd done it all by the time I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and here's this clown talking about something completely foreign to me. I don't even know what he's talking about. And he went on to explain that bathroom sliders in men's john, I think in the ladies too, where they have them pay toilets, good, keen, smart-minded alcoholics slide under the door to avoid paying and save that money for drinking whiskey. And right away I thought, by God, why didn't I think of that? And he went on to explain that whenever he got done doing what he was doing in there, he'd slide back out. Never realizing, of course, that once you're in there, you can turn the handle and walk out, you know. And anybody that thinks like that is a friend of mine. And so I am eternally grateful to the Norm Alpes and the Eddie Regans and the Chuck Chamberlains and the Jimmy Ryans who said things from podiums like this to drunks like me, or I would not be here. I would not be here. I guess it's important in the time we got here that I give you a little bit fast breakdown of what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I don't know about you, but are there any Texans in the room tonight? No Texans. There's a Texan. See, there always is one in the room, you know. I think they move them around a lot, you know. The reason I ask that is when you talk in Texas, if in the first 5 minutes of your talk you don't tell them your sobriety date, you know what? They don't believe you have one. And so in respect to the Texan here tonight, my sobriety date is 13th of January, 1964, which means I've been sober longer than a few of you have been alive. And I know that doesn't impress one person here tonight, but it scares the heck out of me. I didn't come here to get almost 38 years sober, huh? I came here to get all those people off my back, those bill collectors and that woman and those kids and that damn dog and the IRS. And if you got those kind of problems, you're in the right place, you know. But I look back, I'm getting up in years now, and I start to look back at how it all started. And it goes all the way back. And I've come to some conclusions just with my great intellect and better judgment, you know. I figured out that the day I was born, I had two strikes against me right out of the chute, you know. First of all, I was born in a little town in Wisconsin, and you all know how little towns are. Everybody knows everybody's business, and sometimes that's good, and sometimes that's bad. And in my case, it was always bad. And the second strike I had against me was my dad was assistant chief of police in that damn town. And he was about 6'4", weighed 280 pounds, wore a uniform, carried a gun, scared the living bejesus out of you. And for the first 15 years of my life, I did everything that turkey told me to do, just out of fear. Because I knew deep down inside, if he ever hit me, he'd kill me. And he was a big moose and a tough cop, and I was scared to death of him. I mean, little things. If he told me to run to the store, I literally ran to the store. You know, I didn't slow down when I got out of sight, neither. And I'd run all the way back. If he told me to carry out the trash, I carried out everything that even looked like trash. If he told me to rake the leaves, I even raked the neighbor's leaves. And in Wisconsin, they have a lot of snow, and he taught me very early in life. If 5 flakes of snow fall on our sidewalk, it's my job to take it off of there. And I did it out of fear for a long time, until this magical thing that happens to all human beings, everybody here, everybody out there. About the age of 15, something happens to human beings. Medical science can't explain it, but you know what happened to you, and I know what happened to me. And I don't know what was going on in your life when it happened, but all I can do tonight is relate to you as I perceive it, how it happened to me. If you don't believe any of this, go out here and find a 15-year-old. Ask him or her a question on any subject, and you know what? They'll tell you. The smartest thing walking the face of the earth right tonight is a 15-year-old, in their humble opinion. And you are no different, and I was no different. Like I say, I don't know what was going on when it happened to you, and I have this concept, I have this idea how it happened to me. I think it came floating in my bedroom at night, you know, on a cloud or something, and went kaboom. No bells or whistles went off, but the next morning I knew something was different. Because I got up that morning, got dressed, went downstairs, had breakfast, and headed off to school. No big deal. And then I came home from school at noon for lunch, and it was snowing. And I know my job, right? But this thing, it happened in the night. And I said, I just won't do it no more. I don't care what he does, I just won't do it no more. My logic and reasoning at that time was, what will the neighbor say? A genius out there shoveling snow, you know. All of a sudden, it's beneath my station in life. I just won't do it. And I took that snow shovel and set it up against the house and went in and said, heck with him, I just won't do it. Went in the kitchen, sat down at the kitchen table, started to eat my lunch. Then I heard the squad car pull up in front. Then I heard the car door slam. Then I heard the shovel out there on the sidewalk, and I said to myself, it's about time he does something around here. I mean, did you ever have the feeling like you got to do it all? That's the way I felt. He came in the house all out of breath because he wasn't used to that manual labor. I'd been doing it all. Took off that uniform cap and that big heavy Mackinaw they wear in the winter and that Sam Brown belt and that 45. Laid it on the dining room table like he did every day. Came in the kitchen, sat down at the kitchen table right across from me. And then he threw me a curve. He didn't say a word. And if you've just been endowed with the smarts, that will drive you nuts. I'm just waiting for him to say something. I've been saving it for 15 years. I'm going to lay it on him. And he didn't say a word. And I finished my lunch ahead of him, and I had to go back to school. I can remember this situation like it happened yesterday. I got up, walked around the kitchen table, had to go past him, out through the dining room, through the living room, out the front door, back to school. I can't explain this neither, but I'm sure you understand it. I just knew deep down inside, I just could not let a situation like this go by without saying something, you know. And I stopped right in front of him, looked him right in the eye, reached down inside and got one of the pearls of wisdom I'd just been endowed with, right? Looked him right in the eye, said the smartest thing I could think of. I said, is the snow heavy today? Big mistake. He didn't say a word again. He just kind of turned in the chair and came all the way from right field, hit, direct hit. And I took off in the air up against the dining room windows. And when I came to, I developed another bad attitude. I said to myself, and only to myself, nobody can hit me like that and get away with it. I'll get even with him, by God, if it kills me. And in the quiet of my room at night, I used to plan his demise. Now, I understand today that's not proper thinking for a 15-year-old to be planning his father's demise, but that's the way it really was. And I don't want anybody leaving here tonight and think that I was one of those abused children that you read about every day in the Los Angeles Times or see on TV every night. Fact of life. That was the first and only time he ever laid a hand on me. And having had a 15-year-old of my own now, I know today I had it coming. You know, he was just doing what fathers have to do once in a while to upstart young men, especially knock some of that smart aleck crap out of them in the only way he knew how. And I don't begrudge him anymore, but I hated his guts at the time, hated his guts for a long time. But all I'm going to tell you about is these incidents, which I believe had something to do over a period of time to develop my attitude towards people, places, and things. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, my attitude towards people, places, and things was really messed up. But that hit the side of the head was the first of many. About a year after that incident, another big traumatic thing happened. Another cold winter day in Wisconsin. Snow piled up this high all over town. And three of my buddies and I come home from school about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, walk down the street, get to the corner to go down to my house. And there, passed out in the snowbank, dead drunk, is my dad in full uniform. And these three guys started to tease me about my drunk dad, the drunk cop. And we went to Fifth City right there, and I won. But I'll never forget the feelings and emotions I had that day. I realized then and there that he had disgraced that uniform he wore, disgraced that badge he wore, and lost the faith and trust of that community that he had pledged his life to protect and to serve. Big deal. About a year after that incident, another traumatic thing happened. At the age of 47, he died of chronic alcoholism. Didn't say that on his death certificate. He's a big shot in that town. It said heart disease. But those of us who lived with it knew the booze had gotten him. And then I found out another fact of life, that doctors, lie on death certificates to certain people in certain towns, and they're still doing it today. Fact of life. About a year after that incident, another big deal happened in my life. I was going with this gal. When I say we were going together, we started out in kindergarten together. Same kindergarten, same Sunday school, same church, same grade school, same high school. Right out of high school, we got married. It was a beautiful event, crossed white shotguns, everything. She doesn't like me to say that yet. And last January, that was 53 years ago, and she's still there. I'll tell you this, had she known on the 12th of January, 1948, that she was going to go through 16 years of living hell, I know what she'd have told me, because she comes from one of them normsy families, whatever that is. I mean, they did weird stuff, I thought. They go to church on Sundays and picnics in the park and walks in the woods. And I don't know anything about that stuff. And right after we got married, she started to demand things like women do, like furniture to sit on and curtains on the windows and all that stuff. And I don't have any money. And so I go down and see my dad's buddy, the chief of police, and told the chief, she wants all this stuff and I don't have any money. He said, go up to the sheriff's department tomorrow. I think they need help. And any of you who come from a small town, you know the process. One phone call is all it took. Walked into the sheriff's department the next morning to pin a gold badge on me. And I got to be a drunk cop, just like my dad. And time doesn't permit me to tell you what can happen to a drunk cop, except stir up some old resentments, and God knows you probably don't need any more, especially when it comes to cops. Bunch of cop haters right over there. I can spot them a mile away. But I'll tell you right now, if I could be anything right this minute that I could be in this world today, it'd still be a cop. I loved every minute of it. I loved all the excitement, the camaraderie, and everything that goes with being a cop. And I don't know what was going on in your life prior to your entry in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'll tell you another fact of life. Do you know that 99 out of 100 human beings, that isn't only us, that's all those people out there, 99 out of 100 human beings have one thing in their life that's the single most important thing in their life. And in 99 out of 100 cases, that one single thing is another human being. Isn't it incredible? It's another human being. It's a wife, a husband, a lover, a child, a parent, a grandparent, aunts, uncles, somebody is the single most important thing in 99 out of 100 people's lives, except cops. If there's any cops here tonight, don't ask me, ask them. They all have one thing that's above all human things. It's a damn badge. And everybody that's ever carried one will tell you the same thing I'm about to tell you. I'd have done anything short of murder to keep that damn badge, except stay away from one drink of whiskey. And this woman that's been putting up with my crap for a long time, she was pre-Al-Anon then. She's black belt Al-Anon now. If you don't know what a pre-Al-Anon is anyone who really loves a practicing alcoholic and has never been to Al-Anon. They're pre-Al-Anon. I mean, she didn't know anything about alcoholism, Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, Alateen, Alatot, none of that stuff. All she knew is she loved a drunk cop and it was driving her nuts. And at that time in my life, I'm a phony, a cheat, a liar, and a con. If you don't know what a con is, you're looking at one. But I did spot a couple more in here today. Bet all you con artists are here. I don't know about you, but I got really good at it. You know, I could con you out of your socks and you wouldn't even know it. I think I could do it again with a couple weeks' practice. And I had her that close. I had that woman that close to being thoroughly convinced that my drinking was all her fault. And if she'd just get off of my back, everything would be all right. And I don't want any newcomers to think I got a bunch of warrants in my pocket and you start heading for the doors. You know, they took that badge away from me a long time ago. Probably one of the worst nights of my life. Nothing I planned, because like I tell you, if I had my choice right this minute, I'd be out there riding a black and white. But it all came down one night, a bunch of cops and our wives going to have a party. And I don't think there's anything different, incidentally, between a cops party and a civilian party. Except maybe at the cops party, the booze is all free. And that's where drunks like me really shine. I don't know about you, but I personally just loved free booze parties. And I'm not the kind of guy at a free booze party sitting over there in the corner sipping on drinks with little pinky sticking out, you know. I'm back there in the kitchen where the supply is, with both hands, getting all I can get while the getting's good in case they run out, you know. And I don't know how long we're at that party. And she sidled up next to me in the kitchen and says, "We're leaving." I said, "What are you talking about, woman? We just got here." At least it seemed like that to me. I don't know about any of you, but every booze party I've ever been at in my life, it seemed to me there's a magic takes place in the room. And I'm part of the magic, and I'm not leaving. And she looked at me with them cold Al-Anon eyes and said, "We're leaving." And I don't know to this day how she got the keys, because I'm like you, you know. It's my car I drive. I'm sure nobody here ever said that. And she had the keys, and we left. And all the way home, she started bad-mouthing me again about my drinking. And this is the part that's in the book. Newcomers, read the book. It's in the book. This whole scenario is in the book. She started complaining about my drinking, and every alcoholic I know has a little switch up here, and we shut it all off, you know. When people are telling us these god-awful truths that we don't want to hear, we shut it all off, and it don't even hit the eardrum. And she's yakking away, and all of a sudden, I can't explain it to this day. Maybe the switch went on, back on, or whatever. But for the first time in our married life, I started hearing some heavy-duty stuff she's laying on me. She's starting to say things to me like, "How my drinking is affecting our entire life," she said. I said, "Now what are you talking about?" She said, "First of all, it's affecting our social life." I said, "Yeah, how's that?" She said, "We just had to leave that party back there for one reason and one reason only." I said, "Yeah, what's that?" She said, "Because of your dirty, filthy mouth." I'm sure nobody here ever believed that, huh? And then she said, not only that, it's affecting every other aspect of our life. And I said, now what are you talking about? She said, it's affecting our home life, our family life, our kids' lives, our financial life, our sex life. Everything about us is being affected by my drinking. Now I'm certain she flipped her lid or something. And we got in the house and she would not shut up. And I reached for the only thing I know would shut her up, a 38. I said, woman, I've heard all I'm ever going to hear from you about my drinking. I'm going to blow your damn brains out. And she took off like a deer. Out the front door of that house, 6 blocks down the street to the only place she knew she could get help, right? The sheriff's office that I work at. And I'd have got her, too, if she just slowed down. And you'd have a different speaker here tonight, too. I'd probably be up there walking the yard tonight and talking the talk and walking the walk. So I'm eternally grateful to something. Call any damn thing you want to. But I'm eternally grateful right this second that I didn't pull that trigger that night. And I came out of that blackout standing in the middle of the sheriff's office at 3 o'clock in the morning with a 38 in my hand, going to kill somebody. And all the guys are coming off the late shift, and they're all looking at me kind of funny. You know how your family and loved ones and everybody looks at you when you're drunker than a skunk? They look down their nose at you like you're some kind of second-class citizen or something. I can't even describe it. But I'll tell you another fact of life. If you don't know what I'm talking about right this second, you do not belong here. Those people near and dear to us look at us really funny when we're drunken in a skunk. And they were all looking at me kind of funny. And then the old man, the boss of the department, the elected sheriff of that county, heard the ruckus down in the squad room. He came down the squad room and looked at those guys coming off the late shift. And then he looked at me. And he's the only reason I'm in that department. He's a buddy of my dad. That's how it goes. And I know today, being a boss myself, he had to make a management decision right now. And he walked up to me, looked me right in the eye, and said, Bob, hand it over, the badge and the gun. At the age of 31, they took away the badge, the gun, the uniform, and I had to go out there and face that world bare naked. That's too much for a normal person, much less a drunk like me. So at the age of 31, I did the most adult, mature thing I could think of. I ran away from home. If there's any runners here tonight, I want to talk to you outside after the meeting. But you know what? No matter where I go in this country or any other country, these rooms are full of runners. You know that? Running to something, running from something. And every runner who's ever come to Alcoholics Anonymous, including me, we all forgot one thing, and we all forgot the same identical thing. It's incredible. That is, no matter where you're running to or running from, you forgot it, I forgot it. I had to bring me along, and you had to bring you along. And you is the problem, and me is the problem. And you can't make this thing alone, and I can't make this thing alone. But together we can make it. And that's the miracle it talks about in that book. One drunk talking to another, and it works. Works to the tune of over 2 million sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's good enough for me. And I consider myself a very fortunate member of this fellowship, because over the years I've had the privilege, and I mean a privilege, to eyeball 50% of them. Eyeball to eyeball. I believe that's an earned privilege. It is not given. You earn the right to do this and suit up and show up and do what's asked of you in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope and pray before they throw dirt in my face, I'll get to meet them all. But I'll tell you, this has been quite an experience. I mean, if I check out today, I'm still way ahead. If I check out today, I'm still ahead of the game. And so I'm eternally grateful for the time I've been allotted here. I guess it's important in the time allotted I tell you about my last drunk, and then we'll go home. My last drunk was no big deal. I didn't sit around and plan it for 3 weeks or something. It just happened. It was Friday night, 27th of December, 1963. Just finished eating dinner. Made a big announcement to that woman and those kids. Told them I'm going out and have a couple of beers with the guys. I'll be back in 2 hours. And she started that damn rhetoric. You know how they are, that yak, 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 yak. We get fed up with that crap too, you know. And I said, listen, woman, I want to tell you something for the last time. I just put in 40 for a bunch of ingrates around here. And I'm going out there and commiserate with my friends, and I'll be back in 2 hours. Now knock it off. And that was the 27th of December, 1963, at about 7 in the evening. And I got back on the 13th of January, 1964. Can't tell you to this day where the heck I was. I know on the 27th of December, 1963, at about 7:30, I went to my favorite watering hole, a place called The Prelude. Now, isn't that a nice name for a dump? The Prelude has the connotation you're only going to be there for a little bit, you know. The Prelude on Lancashire Boulevard in North Hollywood, which really isn't a heck of a lot to shoot for. It was one of those padded sewers I started to frequent. You bar drinkers know what I'm talking about. I mean, they didn't even have a front door, you know, just curtains hanging there. You know. You've been in one, huh? And sure enough, they were all there. And we started doing the things that real drunks do in bars. You know what? They're doing it right now in bars in Lakeside and in New York City. The same identical things. Not one thing has changed. They're all standing around there talking in millions and spending in dimes, trying to impress people we don't know with money we don't have. If you're a smart drunk like me, you're trying to put the make on some dolly down there at the end of the bar and impress the heck out of her. And you know what? In this group of six guys I went to meet, fact of life, there wasn't one common laborer in the whole bunch. We were all brain surgeons and jet pilots and astronauts and doctors and lawyers and devout liars. But in this group of six guys was a new guy. His name was Pete. And Pete was one of those intellectual giants you meet in bars. You bar drinkers, again, know who I'm talking about. That's that guy or gal who sits down there at the end of the bar and has the answer to every living subject in the world. And they drive people like you and I nuts. And that was Pete. You know, I mean, if you had marital problems and I had marital problems, he had the answers. If you had legal problems, he had the answers. If you had medical problems, he had the answers. If you had engineering problems, he had the answers. I thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread, you know? I thought, how can one guy know so much about so many things? Thank God he continued that drunk with us, because as it turned out, Pete was really quite the guy. He was the one guy in the group who it seemed was always well enough to make the run for the rest of us who were too sick to make the run. Pete could find a jug on election day in a dry state, you know, one of those great guys. And besides that, he had A-negative blood, and I stuck pretty close to him. I just lost half the room here. You know how I know that? No matter where I go in this country or any other country, by the time I hit the parking lot out here, three people at least are going to tap me on the shoulder, ask me the same damn question the world all over. They all say, hey, man, what do you mean by that A-negative blood crap? And just so we don't plug up the parking lot here tonight, I'll tell you ahead of time. First of all, fact of life. If you have A-negative blood, it's rare blood. And second of all, when you're selling it to buy wine, you get more for A-negative than any other kind of blood. And so I stuck close to Pete, you know. I mean, I might have been born at night, but not last night. And I can't tell you the serious events that happened, because we were living in these abandoned cars, one of which was mine. You know how your car gets to be an abandoned car? That's kind of a work of art. The tires are usually flat, the battery's dead, it's out of gas, and it's usually 6 months behind in payment. Then legally it becomes an abandoned car. I never knew that. It also got to be our living room, our kitchen, our bedroom, and our bathroom. Got a little salty in there. And one of those nights, I can't tell you which one, because I was passing in and passing out all the time. One of those mornings, we all came to and Pete didn't. And he had swallowed his tongue that night in a convulsion. And he was deader than a doornail. And I got fighting mad at everything and everybody. And God, if there is a God, because my great intellect and better judgment took over again, I said, God, if there be a God, why would he let a good guy like Pete go, who knows everything there is to know about everything, and let me stay? And then I can't tell you the serious events that happened after Pete was gone. But this is what I never want to forget as long as I live. Early morning on the 13th of January, 1964, some phenomena start taking place. I don't even know what the heck a phenomena is, but some weird stuff started happening. Because all of a sudden, out of that radio came the most beautiful music I ever heard in my life. I know today it was hallucinations because the battery was dead. but it's as real as I'm standing here. It was like the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra was in the car with us. And the thought came to me, man, this thought must be when you die. And whether you believe this or not, everybody sitting here tonight all have a little tape up here that you conjured up and that I conjured up about your concept and my concept of what it's going to be like when we check out. And every one of them is different. And mine had something to do with music being played, and here was the music. And then I got scared. Have you ever been real scared? I mean, really, really scared. I thought cops aren't supposed to get scared. But I got really scared. And for the first time in my adult life, I got down on my knees in that sewer, cried out to a God I was absolutely certain did not exist. And if he did exist, he didn't want anything to do with a drunk like me. But I said the most honest, sincere prayer I've ever uttered in my life. I said, God, if there be a God, the only prayer I know is help me. And through a series of unexplained happenings, which I believe are miracles, I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night, on the 13th of January, 1964. Hasn't been necessary since to go out there be a phony, a cheat, a liar, and a common drunk. And if I get nothing else out of this deal, that mere fact ought to last me a lifetime. I don't know about you, but in my opinion, that mere fact will last me a lifetime, or should last me a lifetime. And I got directed to one of them AA clubhouses through another miracle. And I'm not here to promote them, because some of them I've seen in this country and other countries are dens of iniquity. But the one I went to was not, is not, will not be, as long as I got anything to do with it. And I walked in that door, and there were no meetings going on, just two old goats sitting over there in the corner playing cribbage. And I walked in the door like over there, and they saw me come in the door, and they stopped playing cribbage. And one of them poked the other one and pointed at me, and he said, "See the other one, we better do something with that one, or he's going to start jackknifing around the room here, you know." I mean, I wasn't nervous, just quick, you know. And they applied the only therapy they knew at that time. Did you hear that? The only therapy they knew at that time. They gave me a bucket of paint and a paintbrush, figuring that I could paint faster than anybody else in the place. And I painted that damn clubhouse, and I can't tell you to this day how long I painted. I don't think it means a heck of a lot. But I'll never forget the day I finished. It was a bright Saturday morning. Put away the buckets and the brushes and cleaned everything up just perfect, because we're perfectionists too, you know. Then I found out the truth, that one of them cribbage players had been a painter all his life. And that old thinking came back that fast. Why me, God? Why wasn't he up there painting? And I'll fix their clocks. I'll get drunk at every damn one of these phonies. And I headed out the back door of that clubhouse, bound and determined to quit Alcoholics Anonymous, get drunk at every one of you. And then God, as I understand, God had to perform another miracle, and he had to do it damn fast because I was gone. And you know what? He moved a guy from Riverside, California to Glendale, California that second. Because I reached for that push bar in the back door of that clubhouse like that, and the door opened up ahead of me. And it was on the second story, and there's a little landing out there, and there's this clown standing on a landing, and he has a smile from ear to ear, and he says, "Hi!" And I said, "Shove it!" He says, "Why do you say that to me? I don't even know you." I said, "Shove it anyhow!" He said, "Come here, I want to talk to you." Brought me back in the meeting hall, set me down in them Henroy chairs, not these nice padded ones, the cold metal ones. I told them about them gray-haired goats, and they made me paint that club. And I'm going to get drunk at every one of them. And he ended up being my sponsor. And he said, "If I'm going to be your sponsor, three things are going to happen to you, man. One, you're going to go to meetings. Two, you're going to study that book. And three, for the first time in your adult life, you're going to follow instructions." I thought, how the heck does he know that? And they say at that time there were 700 meetings a week in the greater Los Angeles area, and today there's 2,400 a week. And we made them all. I mean, it was meetings, every night. And newcomers, it's going to happen to you because it's happened to every one of us, so don't feel bad about it. You're going to say to your wife, your husband, your buddy, your girlfriend, meetings, every night. Tonight I'm not going. And that night he came by early. Put me in the car and started down the freeway. I said, "Where are we going tonight?" He said, "We're going to the hole in the ground. E-Bell Club in Huntington Park, California, was started by a guy by the name of Tex Adams, who'd been sober since Lincoln had the measles. And Thank God for people like Tex who started places like that for drunks like me. And he told me I had to study that book. He would not let up. He'd get that book and get, and he was a crusty old bugger anyhow. He'd get me in the corner with that book and he'd start pounding on the book like this and he'd start saying weird stuff, I thought, like between page 1 and 164 of this book is how drunks like him and millions of others before him had found a way of not to die from chronic alcoholism. And he said, and if you don't want to do it, then get the heck away from me. I thought, how can he talk to a sick alcoholic like that? Don't you understand we're sensitive? He literally saved my life. He motivated me to do the one thing I would never have done on my own volition. I cracked the cover of the book and it found me in there. We got to Huntington Park that night and started down the steps into the E-Bell Club. And something weird happened. I think it came all the way from my toes. This feeling came. I think I realized today it was the first honest feeling I'd had in 30 years. Because up until that second, that night, I'm a phony, a cheat, a liar. I tell the truth about nothing. And I tapped Joe on the shoulder and I said, Joe, I got to ask you something. He turned around real gruff and he says, yeah, what do you want now? And I knew he had me. You know, I knew right then he had me. I knew right then and there he was sick and tired of my BS and I knew it. And I asked him that world famous question that all newcomers are compelled to ask their sponsor. How long do I have to go to your damn meeting? And this wise old man with the X-ray vision got fighting mad that fast. Took his index finger and shoved me into the corner outside the meeting hall so they wouldn't hear it inside. When he got me in the corner where I couldn't get away, he started to get violent, you know? He started to hit me in the chest like this and he started to scream. I can hear it yet today. He said, you idiot! I didn't like that. He said, you have to go to meetings until you want to go to meetings. Then you don't have to go to meetings anymore. Didn't make much sense then, but it sure does now. But that night, because he hit me in the chest and screamed at me, I'll fix his clock. I might have to be in the meeting, but I'm not going to listen. A couple here tonight doing that, you know? And I don't know what you do when you're sitting in a meeting not wanting to be in a meeting, but I was uptight like a spring. I'm saying to myself, this jerk, night after night, dragging me to these damn meetings, I'm going crazy. And when you're in that frame of mind, you aren't about to hear anything, but they're smart, you know, them old-timers. They set you here in the front row so you don't nod off, right? And then they said, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, right then and there I made up my mind. I don't want anything you have and I'm not going to any length to get it. But I was trapped. He had the keys and I'm sitting in the front row, you know, so I had to do something to pass the time. So I started staring around the room counting light bulbs. I had a blast in here. And then I ran out of light bulbs. Then I started winking at girls. And then I run out of girls. There's still a lot of time left in the meeting. I spot this guy about halfway back. And he's scribbling on a piece of paper. I didn't know you had to take notes here, you know. And he's scribbling on this piece of paper. And I'm watching him. Halfway through the meeting, I watched him like a hawk, you know. I'm nosy. I'm ex-cop. I'm nosy by nature. And I watched him. He got out of the chair and started for the door. I didn't know you could do that. And he split. He took that piece of paper, stuck it on the bulletin board, and split. And I'm nosy, and I got to find out what's on that piece of paper, right? And I sneak over there and get that piece of paper off that bulletin board. Don't tell me there's any miracles around here. You know what was on that piece of paper? It was a little poem about drunks. And I read it, and it made sense. And I stole it. Took it along home. And on the days when I was absolutely certain, I just can't make this thing, you know? It might be all right for you clowns, but I can't make it. And yet, I didn't want to go back out there in those damn cold cars and start drinking rot-gut wine again. and die like my buddy Pete. So I get it out of my billfold and read it, save my can a million times, and I want to thank Janet for asking me to be here tonight. It's a little poem entitled, Which Place? I dreamed one night I passed away and left this world behind. Started down that lonesome trail, some of my friends to find. Came to a signboard on a trail, directions it did tell. Keep right to go to heaven, turn left to go to hell. I hadn't been too good on earth, just a hopeless, boozing wreck. And knew that at the crossroads, the path I'd have to take. So I started on a rocky path that leads to Satan's place, and shook within not knowing just what I'd have to face. Old Satan met me at the gate, what's your name, my friend? I said, I'm just old Sober Sam that's come to a sad end. He glanced through some files, you made a mistake, I fear. You're listed as an alcoholic. We don't want you here. I said, I'm looking for my friends. And a smile stole over his face. If your friends are alcoholic, they're in the other place. So I went back the other way to the crossroads I did see and turned right to heaven, as happy as could be. St. Peter smiled and said, come in. For you, I have a berth. You're an alcoholic. You've been through hell on earth. I saw old Dove and old Pete too, Bill C. and a friend called Bell. And brother, I was tickled as I thought they'd gone to hell. So brothers, I'll take warning. Learn something from my trip. You've got a place in heaven if you try hard not to slip. If someone tempts you with a drink when you're not feeling well, just tell him you're going to heaven and he can go to hell. Thank you.